This is the takeaway for Wednesday, July 1st, 2015.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There is a community of human beings who constitute a nation of no flag, no border, no common language, people that live in the northern and southern hemispheres, the eastern and western hemispheres. They number 23 in the top 25 most populous nations on Earth, and they have no name. They can't vote. They have no leader, no government. They are the 60 million refugees or displaced persons pushed from their homes by war, conflict, or oppression. This number, announced this spring by the United Nations, represents a scale of homeless, stateless people unknown in human history. This hour, two voices of this crisis, a life and death struggle to escape a life and death struggle in a homeland crumbling. Just this year, 1,700 people from Africa and the Middle East have died trying to cross the Mediterranean. What is the responsibility of the rest of the world? The United States has taken in more refugees than any other country, but is that even close to what is needed? Simon Henshaw is a principal deputy assistant secretary at the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. He has a lot of power, but he also has one of the best views of a 21st century crisis spiraling out of control.
First of all, there is actually a difference between refugees and internally displaced persons in this manner. Refugees do have a special protection guaranteed by two conventions, one from the 50s and one from the 60s, which protect them, which require countries to protect them when they enter and provide certain services to them. And the international community has done a great job of that in the past 50 years in taking care of refugees and making sure that they're protected. There are really two problems that are leading from that. One is just the overall number is making it hard to deal with all these people. And secondly, internally displaced people don't have the same sort of protection because of sovereignty concerns within each country where this is going on. These people don't have a voice, you're right. All they have are the clothes on their backs when they run away, and they survive due to benefits given to them by international organizations and others. So it's very hard for them to have a voice in today's world.
Is this a product of the proliferating population in a planet where there's 7 billion people? Are there going to be 60 million refugees and displaced people? And, you know, is that a decent figure given the population of the world these days? Or is there something else driving this that really puts it out of scale?
I can only give you a personal answer there. And my feeling is, no, that's not the case. The real problem is the expansion of political violence around the world in many different places.
Is there a regional manifestation of this that concerns the State Department, or is it basically the same face of this displacement wherever you go?
What really concerns us is that this is spread worldwide through a number of regions. It's not just in one single region. There are issues in Southeast Asia. There are issues in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Obviously, there are long-term issues in Africa, which have gotten worse in the last few years, the Middle East. But they're even in our own hemisphere, in Colombia, with the internally displaced persons. That's the largest number of internally displaced persons in the world inside Colombia. So one of the scary things is about how widespread this is.
Are our arms spread wide for these refugees and displaced persons in the United States, or is it much more complicated than that?
You know, I think Americans should be really proud of what their government does here. First of all, we're the leaders in diplomacy and looking for peaceful solutions to many of these conflicts, and that's what's really required, ending these wars and finding peace. On the humanitarian front, we are the largest contributor, $6 billion a year, B for a billion. And we give far more than any other country in supporting refugees and internally displaced persons. And our aid is based not on political causes, but on need of refugees and internally displaced persons.
And is there a particular place that you wish we could have better representation in resettling right now in the world, a trouble spot that concerns you more than others?
I think the biggest trouble spot right now is the Middle East, and we're very focused on increasing numbers of Syrian refugees and other refugees from the region. But I don't want to discount refugees from many other areas. We have a large African program right now, and we're increasing the number of Congolese that are coming to the country, for instance.
Would you say the process for a refugee to come to the United States is complicated, is simple, that if it is complicated, that people can get ready assistance?
It's complicated. There's no way around that. We've certain security concerns and health concerns as well. So we've a long, drawn out process which makes sure that people coming to the United States are not a threat to our national security.
Finally, Simon, what do you say to the argument that with 60 million displaced or refugees, that this problem is out of control of the existing infrastructure, that it's basically left the barn and the barnyard, and it really would take some fundamentally different kind of infrastructure to deal with the numbers that are coming in the next few decades?
I think it's absolutely true that the numbers have reached beyond the abilities of humanitarians to deal with. I don't want to predict that the situation will get worse in the coming decades. I hope that world leaders find a way to end these conflicts and that people can start going home.
Simon Henshaw, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Simon Henshaw is Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. Could one voice speak for all of the refugees in the world? Each story different, each person with his own family, his or her own language? Kiflu Hussein is one voice of the millions of refugees pushed from East Africa alone. Born and raised in Ethiopia, Kiflu Hussein is a human rights attorney who was thrown in prison on charges of corruption. He sought asylum in Uganda, lived there for 7 years, waiting to be granted asylum in the United States, where he lives today in Dallas, a refugee. He's now a research associate at the engineering school at Southern Methodist University. He knows he's lucky. He says he never stops thinking of home and the millions like him from all over the world who just wait.
Before I made it to Texas, as you know, many people like me from the third world, we have high expectation of United States in terms of economy, in terms of freedom, and some of the expectation is unrealistic. There are some folks from my continent who think that coming to the United States is like getting to heaven. We consider United States as a symbol of freedom, justice, equality. And sometimes you find some contradiction. You come here, okay, you get protection, that is good, but you never forget your people, your country. The situation in Ethiopia in terms of freedom is really deteriorating, even in terms of economy. And yet, on the other hand, the government of the United States is kind of cozy with the current regime. So that is a contradiction to me. While I'm so happy being resettled in the United States, getting all kinds of opportunity, the future is bright for me, for my kids. But at the same time, I ask myself sometimes, what is the point?
Well, Kiflu, let's talk about what could improve the situation. Do you think the United States has more clout in trying to make governments around the world that have problems with the refugees more free, more tolerant, so that people wouldn't leave? Do you think the United States needs to get more involved in direct economic aid to improve the economies of those countries? Yeah. Or do you think there needs to be a better process for people declaring that they want to leave and go to another country like the United States so they don't have to do what you had to do, fleeing to Uganda for 7 years and making your way overland to Dallas, practically?
What the United States can do is have strong stance on regimes like Eritrea, Zimbabwe. But when it comes to the regimes like my country, it's kind of soft. So that seems to be a double standard. President Obama, when he was in Ghana, he made a remark that United States gives support to individuals and institutions that are responsible. Regimes like the Ethiopian one are not responsible. There is evidence, ample evidence. So that is what has to stop. It has to be questioned, where do all the money go? Why does Ethiopia have all these desperate migrants? Is really the economy improving? There are so many prisoners in Ethiopia. Independent organizations like Red Cross, Amnesty International cannot access this prison facilities, people who are in terrible, highly congested prisons, the human rights violations. There are so many problems.
Kiflu, if you were to speak to all of the refugees that are out there, all of the 20 million refugees worldwide, and try to say something that might unite them to give them more political clout, all of you more political clout in the international community, what would it be? What would you say?
I would say, let's get together on the ticket of humanity, not on fickle politics. For any country to meaningfully develop, a human being should be respected. His potential should be recognized. When a human being is respected and when his potential is recognized, forced displacement should stop. They have to be free to live in their own country, to work in their own country, and to prosper in their own country without fear of persecution.
How do you think that could be accomplished?
One, I think, by continuing to speak up the truth and by not giving up. There were many times that I came to giving up, you know. It has been 8 years since I left my country, and the situation is not changing. It's deteriorating. So I'm asking myself sometimes, am I a fool? So by not giving up, by continuously speaking up the truth.
What would you say to someone back home who you know is being persecuted right now?
This may sound so ironical, but I would say to them, before you flee from your country, think long and hard. If there is a life-threatening situation, and then if you have to flee, then flee. But otherwise, think long and hard. Sometimes there is this illusion that you would have better conditions, especially in the Western world. The reality is not. The way I fled, I'm lucky. I left my country through the airport, and then I landed in Uganda. And then after some time, even though the process was protracted, the way I resettled in the United States, the process is smooth. I came to the United States safely. But for some, it's not like that. So I say, think, you know, long and hard before you flee, before you decide to flee.
Well, Kiflu, we're glad that you're here, and we're certainly glad to hear you speak in a voice that at least evokes some of the issues that all 20 million refugees worldwide can relate to. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Kiflu Hussein is a refugee from Ethiopia. Today, he's resettled in Texas and working as a research associate at the Engineering School at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. The financial markets lately have been bobbing up and down like a dizzy musician at, that's right, a Greek wedding, as Greece and the Eurozone try to resolve their debt madness. News of a new bailout deal sent markets higher today, as it seems the Greeks are capitulating to most creditor demands. What are the referendum Prime Minister Tsipras has scheduled for the weekend to allow voters to decide whether to accept the terms? Well, millions of Greek expatriates around the world are asking the same questions as the fates of family and friends hang in the balance. Austerity pushed Peter Charitopoulos to move to the U.S. from Greece in 2011. He now works as a web designer here in New York and is in the studio. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Pins and needles.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. So how are you communicating with your family? What's the sort of day-by-day TikTok of what's going on in your world?
You know, the Greeks have used to going abroad and working since the 60s. So we are very used to have our families far away. But thank God now that we have the technology, and the technology gives us the ability of speaking with the family almost anytime that we want. I'm talking in Skype with my family and friends and emails. They're sending me emails and they want to talk to me, and maybe they can find out something that comes from here, from the United States, and it's about them, you know, what's happening with IMF, if you heard something, what the people are telling there. It's a very stressful period of the Greek economy. It's been stressful since 2010. And, you know, that what is happening today, it's not something new. The only difference is that this time there is a government that just said no. They said no to the austerity measures. Because for the past 5 years, it was 2010, every 6 months we have this kind of situation where the creditors are coming in, they say, you didn't do what exactly we wanted you to do, so you need to cut more wages, you need to cut more pensions. But back then we had governments that they would simply say, yes, there's no problem. And the only difference now is that this government said no.
They said no for a longer time before they said yes.
We don't know if they're going to say yes. And this is what's happening now in Greece, because there's so many different information coming in from different places that they say the government will say yes. No, no, the government will say no. And people are frustrated because they don't know what really is happening.
We talked with a correspondent this week who said that Greece has been shifting to an all-cash economy for a while, that essentially transactions take place without the need for ATMs and banks, and there's even a bartering trade going on. How does that work?
Well, since forever, Greece never really used the plastic money. You will see very few people using credit cards or debit cards. even back in the good old days, you were able to see people standing in line in the banks, in the bank branch, in order to get their pension, their payment from their job. They didn't really use plastic money. They're not used to do that. So now that they're telling them, you know what, you can go with your card and, you know, do your transaction, that doesn't really seems like a good idea for them.
They don't trust it.
They don't trust. They really trust. Since forever, the Greeks really trust cash. And now that there is this, there's no money, there's no cash in the market, everybody's getting very frustrated about that.
Have you heard of payrolls not being met? I mean, that's part of the reason why you came to the United States. You couldn't get paid to do what you wanted to do.
Well, you know, that thing was happening also back in the old good days. You could see payrolls getting delayed. It was the mentality. It was the mentality of, especially if you were, Greece's Athens and Thessaloniki, those two big cities. In all other places, it's the same situation. Mm. So you could see in all other places, companies that were delaying the payments, they were trying to pay something else first, and then they're going to pay the employees. That was the mentality. Now, I didn't heard anything. My father went on Friday, and he got his pension. He didn't have any problem.
Really? Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But now I'm hearing for people that the money is in the bank, but they need to go every day because there's this limit of 60 euros per day. But they're saying that they're getting the money. It's just that they're getting it in payments.
Have you heard of any resourcefulness? I mean, Greeks over a long period of time have learned to be very, very resourceful in the wake of financial instability and uncertainty. Anybody told you a story of how a great big dinner was put together despite the cash problems? Party went ahead, no problem at all. Birthday presents, anything like that?
You know, I've got a lot of friends in Facebook. The 50% of the posting that I'm seeing is about the crisis. The other 50% I'm seeing is about having fun in the sun in a beach bar.
Yeah, so life goes on.
Yes, for some people life goes on. I guess it's the environment. It's the sun and the blue sky and the sea that sometimes makes us feel very laid back.
Like there's a few more hours left.
Exactly.
Even when the Germans say there's not a few more hours.
There's this saying in Greece that the big God of Greece will help us, so we don't need to worry.
Does anyone care if this Eurozone thing goes away, if suddenly you're back to drachmas?
Yes, it seems like there are a lot of people that care about the Eurozone. Yesterday we had that people protesting for the favor of the Eurozone yesterday. On Monday we had the people protesting against the Eurozone. We are divided in two parties, the people that are voting for the yes and the people that are voting for the no. It seems that there's a lot of people that care about the Euro, but, you know, we have 1.5 million people unemployment. We have 28% of unemployment. In this percent, we're not including the people that have left the country. In that percent, we're not including the people that are working just 2 days a week. So, you know, so if we see the real unemployment, it will be more than 40-45%. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that those people being in unemployment for so many years now, they really care if they do have a euro or a drachma in their pockets.
Well, one thing is certain. They'll take dollars.
This is something that is like a rumor and it's been heard a lot. There was a rumor that the government will not go straight to the drachma, but maybe we're going to use the dollar for a couple of days or months. But, you know, we just need to wait and see.
Peter Charitopoulos is a web designer in New York and a Greek immigrant. He moved to the U.S. in 2011 after the austerity measures back then made it impossible for him to find work in Greece. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
In the dark times of old, the world was engulfed in foulness and decay. The waters receded, the bitter rains fell. Civilization was powerless in the face of steadily rising temperatures, and lands and cities that had thrived for hundreds of years vanished without a trace. All was lost until an alliance of spiritual leaders called for an end to denial and delusion. The one named Pope Francis condemned the fools who would ridicule expressions of concern for the environment. In this episode, the rabbis speak of a tradition to preserve the earth that goes far back to the very beginning of time.
All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us.
I'm not talking about hobbits and magic rings here, but the real attempts to reverse environmental damage being made by religious leaders today. In our series, God's Plan, Faith Communities Mobilize on the Environment, we look at how Jewish leaders have both embraced Pope Francis's historical encyclical on the environment and reminded the faithful of how environmental activism arises naturally out of the Jewish doctrine of pikuach nefesh, saving human lives and keeping the world safe for future generations. Rabbi Lawrence Troster is founder and coordinator of Shamrei Breshet, Rabbis and Cantors for the Earth. And Rabbi Steve Gutto is president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and chair of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. Rabbi Troster says it's nice to all be on the same side on this issue.
The Pope very specifically addresses the encyclical to everybody in the world, which is unique and unprecedented, because he really wants to start a worldwide conversation of people of all faith and scientists and economists and business people. So this is something different.
And would you say it's an opportunity to express the power of all of these religions together, something we haven't seen a lot of so far this century?
I think the world's scared to death. Those of us that know the science and understand faith, for a breakthrough in saying that this is going to change our lives if we don't deal with it. And when the Pope, who is a pretty powerful man, comes out and says, we've got to stop it, we'd be stupid not to look at our own faiths and try to bring them all together in a fairly spiritual and scientific and moral way.
What are the advantages you see of addressing the environment through a religious dimension, and what are the limitations, do you think?
Well, we don't pretend to be scientists, but we listen to scientists, we talk to scientists, we learn from scientists. So we can't come from that stance. But what we can do in the religious environmental movement, what we have been doing for decades, is come from a moral perspective. What are the moral implications of what is going on? And that, I think, is where the religious community has been particularly effective in saying, what is the disparity between the use of resources and those people who are suffering from the degradation resulting from that resources? That's where the religious community, I think, has been very effective.
This is a critique of capitalism and consumerism. Does that work in the kind of morality that gets preached in the synagogues around the world, Rabbi?
I think one of the things that he does a really good job of is critiquing what we mean by technological and economic progress. And I think that finds resonance in a lot of religious traditions. I don't know a religious tradition that promotes conspicuous consumption. And so he's asking us to look, especially those of us in the wealthy nations, what is it we are doing by this consumption that is having an impact negatively on the rest of the world?
That's Rabbi Lawrence Troster, and we're also speaking with Rabbi Steve Gutto, who's the president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and chair of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. Rabbi Gutto, let's talk about the limits of what a religious leader can reasonably order the faithful to do.
It's not part of the Jewish tradition in a serious way. It certainly has been part of the Catholic tradition up to a point, although we all know that the Pope can only go so far even among his own people. But the real effect of what the Pope says among Catholics more seriously and among Jews and Christians and Muslims and others is that he's an effective teacher and leader, and rabbis are effective teachers and leaders at their best. And that's our job. And it's not about telling. It's about urging people to move forward, to advocate, to try to make a difference in their own homes, in their own businesses, and in their own political worlds.
We have to act as individuals and as communities, and we've got to link together, as Steve has pointed out. We've got to pull together all people of faith because it's a universal human crisis.
Since the little blue ball picture of the Earth was broadcast around the world after Apollo 11, people have had a sense of brotherhood of man. We're living on a fragile planet, you know, that sort of thing. But it seems that this issue makes the planetary domain more specific in some way in this century. You could kind of see it in the picture, but there's something about climate change that really creates a sort of borderless Earth that I think the church is dealing with for the first time here. How does coming together as faiths make this point in this century for the very first time?
I think the answer is faiths rarely do come together. And the fact is that so many of us are using the words of the Pope not just to say, this is what the Catholics are doing, but as to say, this is what we have to do.
Are you on the Vatican's team on this one, or is the Vatican on your team, Larry?
I think one of the things that is different in this century is the sense of interconnection through electronic media has grown so intense and also so intimate, we are more aware of things that are going on the other side of the world so quickly that I think this has helped to create a sense of moral interconnectedness. And that's, I think, is what's different now.
A few years ago, I was at a conference, international conference. You know, everybody was speaking different languages. And I was on a panel, and the person that was the moderator was the secretary to the Pope, Benedict. And I remember saying to him at that conference, I don't know, Larry, if I ever told you this. No. I said to the secretary, I said, if you go back and get your boss to make an announcement, then over a billion people in the world have to listen and the rest of us have to do something. And nothing ever happened until, I mean, Benedict did say a few things, but nothing ever happened until now. And I felt morally compelled. I'm sure no one took my message back, but I felt morally compelled that I'd actually made that promise and we better do something.
Rabbi Lawrence Troster is the founder and coordinator of Shomrei Breshet, Rabbis and Cantors for the Earth. And Rabbi Steve Gutto is president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and chair of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment.
My name is Michael Shaw. I'm calling from Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Environmental issues have been discussed in churches and synagogues I have visited. These are some of the only places in which I hear the tremendous danger from toxic fracking discussed. Why don't we care more about our children's future world?
Ever hear environmental issues spoken from the pulpit?
Hi, this is Eileen McGuire from Westfield, New Jersey. I am Roman Catholic, and I have never heard environmental issues discussed at Mass in my 49 years.
You can join the conversation. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. As we follow this topic all week, head over to thetakeaway.org for full coverage in a series we're calling God's Plan, Faith Communities Mobilize on the Environment. Finally, this hour, in so many of the racially charged headlines over the past 2 years, the common denominator has been the presence of a firearm. No gun, no deaths in Charleston last month. No gun and no fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. No gun and no fatal shooting of Walter Scott in South Carolina. In one of those cases, the gun was in possession of a civilian. In the other two, it was white police officers who pulled their guns in an altercation. We talk a lot about removing guns from circulation in America at large, but nothing is ever done about it. We never talk about removing guns from the hands of police. What would happen if we simply subtracted the guns from encounters between law enforcement and civilians? Well, if you could, you might end up with a situation in Britain, where very few police officers carry guns. Handguns and assault rifles are completely banned, and the percentage of civilians with guns is low, which partially explains how in 2012, according to data compiled by the FBI, 409 Americans were killed by police shootings, but for the same year in Britain, the figure was just one. Sir Peter Fahey is chief of the Greater Manchester Police. He oversees 6,700 officers, and only 209 of them are armed.
The context, really, I suppose, in the UK starts from a position that we are a routinely unarmed police force. But on the other hand, we do deal with very dangerous situations where offenders do have knives or other serious weapons. So, number one, you start from a very strong selection process. But then the whole way that we train officers is almost an absolute last resort is to use your firearm. And it's about when you get into a situation that you assess the situation, that you give yourself other options, and starts from a position always that for any police officer, the best weapon is their mouth. But as I say, it exists within really also a public context where the public treat extremely seriously a police officer firing their weapon, where the legal system sets a very high bar, really. So, for instance, in the 40 years of the history of Greater Manchester Police, we only shot dead two people over that whole period. And, you know, we cover a very busy city with a population of 2.7 million. But I think it's also the situation that you put your police officers into. We've done a lot of work on mental health issues. If you end up using your police force as an outreach for mental health services, then the trouble is that police officers end up having to deal with people often who are, you know, disordered in different ways, are suffering from mental illness. And the trouble is then a police officer in that situation only often has a, you know, firearm as the means of which they're dealing with that. So we've worked very, very strongly with our health service to try and make sure that it is health workers who respond to mental health crisis, not police officers.
One of the curious dynamics I think that we should explore here is that whenever there is an incident like the shooting in Charleston or Newtown or any of the places I could name, the pushback is okay, liberals are going to use this as an opportunity to crack down on guns. We have to push back on this and make sure that, nothing happens in response to this kind of terrible crime, and we condemn it, of course. It seems to be just the opposite in Britain. If you go back to the Ryan massacre in 1987, that led to the banning of all semi-automatic weapons. And 9 years later, when Thomas Hamilton killed 16 schoolchildren in Dunblane, Parliament banned all handguns. And there's a mandatory 5-year jail sentence for possession. How does that work if it can't work here?
No, I think your analysis is absolutely spot on. That was the reaction to those various tragedies. We have incredibly tight gun laws, and I think that is a big issue behind this. But on the other hand, I think you have to accept the reality of the political and the public culture in the United States. And you know, I am struck when I do go to some American cities, the number of people who appear to be on the sidewalk who clearly are suffering from mental health issues. And the trouble is, as I say, if you use your police force as the outreach service to deal with those people, then the trouble is they often end up in situations where that person's demeanour ends up with them getting shot. I think what has made a big difference for us is a much better way of working with mental health services, and also trying to make sure, you know, deaths also occur in custody blocks, in cell blocks. And again, it's also really important that you're not bringing people with mental health issues into police custody blocks. And I think that should be the focus, because, you know, I think realistically, you know, you're not going to change the gun culture in the United States, but it's more about the way that police officers have to deal with other incidents where people may be carrying other types of weapons, but where there should be other ways of trying to deal with that other than shooting them dead.
Would you say that, based on your own experience as an officer, that you typically knew the people on the street that you were encountering, that officers are much closer in the community and are taught to be much closer into the communities where they serve?
Yeah, I would say that. And I think that is another, you know, crucial issue here. Often you find that the people that you're coming into contact with, some of the criminals, particularly some of the people suffering from mental health issues, they're often extremely well known to local officers. And if those local officers have a relationship with that person, often if they're called to the incident, again, they can use that relationship and familiarity to, you know, talk that person out of what they're doing. So that local knowledge, that local, you know, familiarity is really, really important. It's putting in a whole structure and a whole system of policing, which is very much based on understanding the area, keeping the same officers in that area, them being judged about their effectiveness in solving the problems in those areas, not by some other set of targets or some other particular priority which is not important to that community. And so we actually, to be fair, we introduced a new type of colleague, probably about 10 years ago, called a police community support officer. And these colleagues have no police powers, and their job is, as it says on the tin, they go out there to support the community, and they just build relationships, they encourage volunteering. And I can only tell you, you know, we were a bit skeptical about them at the beginning, but they've just been enormously valuable because policing is all based on relationships.
How do you deal with race there in the UK? And I know it's difficult to compare, but why do you think, or do you think, that the United States seems to get race so wrong in some of these incidents between law enforcement and civilians?
I'm not sure we are a lot better. You know, we've had incidents, the riots that we had in this country in 2011 followed the shooting of a black person in London, which has sadly followed a pattern we'd seen in many other incidents. So, you know, there continue to be serious issues. That said, I think by, you know, the form of neighbourhood policing that we use, about putting a huge emphasis on hate crime, on crimes motivated by hatred and prejudice, about being very active in dealing with community tensions, and we've got big issues at the moment around our Muslim population, particularly because of the terrorist situation, but about being very proactive about those sorts of issues. You know, it gives you a chance, but, you know, I wouldn't want to say that the British police has had a huge amount more success. I think what does strike me when I go to the United States is that you have a lot more black police officers, you have a lot more black police chiefs. But I know, again, talking to some of those officers, that if the local people still feel that that badge is a symbol of an unfair system, then the trouble is often it doesn't really matter whether you're a black officer or a white officer. So I come back to it really that, you know, for the police to be successful on issues like race, then essentially you need a population that basically feels that they're getting a fair chance, that the system is fair to them. And I think, you know, possibly they are the issues that we've made some progress on.
Sir Peter Fahey, Chief Constable of the Greater Manchester Police and the Association of Chief Police Officers, spokesman on workforce development, currently commanding 6,700 officers, only 209 of which are armed. Sir Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And here's something to take with you. It's exactly what German soccer fans will be thinking about all day. That second goal at the end of the second period as Team USA humbled the German team 2-0 to advance to the Women's World Cup finals. Our friend Brandi Chastain, former defender and forward on the U.S. team, couldn't resist a play-by-play of that 84th minute. Abby Wambach to Carly Lloyd to Kelly O'Hara to score.
What was great about what Carly did was prior to crossing the ball was she hesitated. And that got the defender to hesitate as well. And she dragged the ball with her right foot to her left foot end line and then played a very difficult ball for Onger because it was in the what we would call the no man's land. It's not right to her, but it's in between her and the defender. And perfect job by Kelly O'Hara to just slip in right before the defender and hit it with the outside of her right foot into the goal.
I think I blacked out for a second, to be honest. I'm so thankful to have had that opportunity to like lift the team and, you know, contribute in that way because those girls fought so hard for, you know, 90 plus minutes.
You can hear an extended version of my conversation with Brandi. Just visit thetakeaway.org. That's all for today. Go Team USA. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Mandarin, mobile app development, and mindfulness. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.